Good morning, everyone. Good to have you here this morning. If you would get a Bible and be ready to study along with us as we continue in our series of studies, we're looking at pressing toward the goal. We're going to continue in this series of studies this morning. We've got another one in a couple of weeks, and I'm just going to tell you right now these next couple of lessons are going to be uncomfortable to preach and uncomfortable to hear because they are subjects we need to hear about. As uncomfortable as they may be, because we need to be prepared for the world in which we live. As we talked about last week in the series of lessons from Brother Gray, we need to know our times and we need to know what we need to do. And this is one of those things we need to be prepared for. And I hope we all know, if we do not, we need to know, that we can never assume that the things we're going to be talking about in these lessons and I've already talked about, we can't think that they will never happen, quote unquote, here, or never affect us as members of this particular church. Some of the things we've already covered, some of the things we will cover in future lessons, have already touched congregations here in our area and in other places. And I would guess that most, if not all of the members of those congregations, might have believed that it never would have happened there either. And the fact is, whether we like to admit it or not, sin touches every congregation because congregations are composed of people and people sin. As we all well know, we have all sinned and fall short of the glory of God, Romans 3 and verse 23. But even as people of God, we still sin, 1 John 1 verses 8 and 10. Cannot say that we do not sin. And when we start thinking that certain sins won't affect us, that's a dangerous line of thinking. Like all temptation, the lure of sin appeals to our own desires, and this one is no different. Subject of today's lesson is a subject I believe is well known to most of us here today, an issue that has increasingly become one that affects members of the Lord's church and will continue to do so unless the drastic changes take place in this world, which I don't see happening anytime soon, if ever. Parents, I hope you're listening this morning. Teenagers, I hope you're listening this morning because this is an issue that affects you or will. And I probably don't have to tell any of you here today that we've seen some changes in our society and their views on sexual issues in the last few decades, for those of you who have lived a few decades. And these societal changes have affected the way that even believers perceive the matter. And that fact and a failure to address the issue properly has resulted in many of our children being drawn into the world because of the lure of sexual pleasure and fulfillment and not knowing how to answer the temptation. As difficult as it may be to talk about, we need to equip our children to fight this fight also, to help them know the truth thoroughly, that they may be able to recognize the lie, and to help them and ourselves to defeat our enemy's assault on the Lord's church, on our homes, and on our country. Today I want us to consider the matter of sexual immorality. And the passage was read earlier in Hebrews the 3rd chapter in verse 4. God tells us there that it is the marriage bed that is undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God would judge. I want us to see that God has given us a law regarding sexual morality. And with that being true, we need to know how we can live that we have, as the writer puts here, beds that are undefiled. We'll begin by doing a short look at some certain notable events that have happened in our country's history that have played a part in the changes that have been brought about in the last few decades, and then note the results of those changes and their effects on the Lord's church. We will end by looking at what God's Word says about the matter and some general truths that apply to this subject in particular, and how we must fight against the intrusion into the house of God in our own homes, and why we need to fight. Let's begin by looking at a short history of what is called the sexual revolution in the United States. Let's go a few years back into the Victorian era in what's called Puritanism. Most of the repressive attitudes towards sexual behavior have been attributed to the Victorian era, which is the period from 1837 to 1901, or American Puritanism. But even the adherents of the modern free love movement recognized that the attitudes towards sexual behavior in those times and by the Puritans was not necessarily repressive. The attitudes towards sexual behavior during the Victorian era and by Puritans was such that the general belief was that there was a proper place for sexual activity and even pleasure, that is, in marriage with one's own spouse, and that any and all sexual behavior outside that realm was deemed illicit and or destructive. But that wasn't really the problem. What we had somewhere along this line was institutionalized sexual repression. In what is called the church, but let's be more particular here, in the Roman Catholic Church. I want you to see some of the teachings that existed and still do exist. And this is in reference to the idea of the teachings regarding sexual behavior in the Roman Catholic Church and why it even arose. In the Science Encyclopedia, it said total chastity, in accordance with the ideal of Paul and the Church Fathers, was a matter of course, for all who took their priestly role or monasticism seriously. The intensification of Catholic asceticism since the 12th century was to a large extent a reaction of these practices to the libertines, an attempt, in other words, to outdo these heretical dualists. In other words, what he's saying here is you had a group of people who wanted no restrictions, and in response to that, the Catholic Church wrote restrictions that went further than what the Bible taught. Went from one extreme to the other, is what he's saying. This is a teaching by Pope Pius XI in 1930, which is still part of church doctrine today. Since, therefore, the conjugal act is destined primarily by nature for the begetting of children, those who, in exercising it, deliberately frustrate its natural power and purpose, sin against nature and commit a deed which is disgraceful, intrinsically vicious. Any use whatsoever of matrimony exercised in such a way that the act is deliberately frustrated in its natural power to generate life is an offense against the law of God and nature. Those who indulge in such are branded with the guilt of a grave sin. What he's talking about here is contraception. Or if you use even natural contraception, where if you don't produce a child in the sexual act, he said it's a sin against God. And furthermore, in 1983, Pope John Paul II, in an address on responsible procreation, said contraception is to be judged objectively, so profoundly illicit that it can never for any reason be justified. To think or to say anything to the contrary is tantamount to saying that in human life there can be situations where it's legitimate not to recognize God as God. This is what they're saying. You're playing God if you control whether or not you produce a child. Users of contraception attribute to themselves a power that belongs only to God, the power to decide in the final instance the coming into existence of a human being. It's teachings like this that people rebelled against and said the church is repressive. What they meant is the Roman Catholic Church, but they applied it to the church of Jesus Christ. Anybody religious, in other words. So, of course, those who sought unrestrained sexual liberties ran to the other extreme and denied even the biblically legitimate teachings and convinced others to follow them in opposing all church teachings because of the errors of a few. And one of the movements that is notable for its part in changing the way Americans viewed sexual behavior was the free love movement. It's older than what we might think. It was first recognized as a movement in the late 1800s. And it began with the assertion that women could decide for themselves what sexual relations they could engage in, as a rebellion then against marriage, which was perceived as enslavement. And in the 1960s, this became a social movement, more as an offshoot of anarchism, which was rebellion against all authority, and was often correctly associated with sexual promiscuity, especially in reference to what was then called counterculture of the 1960s and 70s. And there were more organized groups within the free love movement that were united to oppose any and all laws that restricted, condemned, or regulated adultery, divorce, the age of consent, birth control, homosexuality, abortion, and prostitution. Anything to do with the sexual behavior. And so this movement in any age was closely associated with and often in direct partnership with the feminist movements. Again, remembering that it was in opposition to marriage in the beginning because they saw it as enslavement. And as we look at these attitudes towards sexual immorality and the laxity toward this, we shouldn't deny that there have been many errors propagated by men on the matter of sexual behavior. If anything, we should be freely willing to admit the errors and identify them as such so that the truth may be discovered and then followed. We're not going to do an in-depth study on all the teachings on this, but we need to know that that is the case. But then we have the American sexual revolution, and I think it would be good to stop for a minute and make clear what this sexual revolution is. And by definition, it is the deconditioning of society and development of new codes of sexual behavior, many of which are now integrated into the mainstream. In other words, it was changing the whole society's ideas and views and attitudes about sexual behavior. And as we just talked about, it was the gradual relaxation and elimination of laws regarding previously prohibited sexual behavior and then the acceptance of certain sexual practices once considered both illegal and even repulsive. It would be very difficult to trace the history of the modern American sexual revolution to a particular point in time, and it's not possible to tie it to any one factor. There were a lot of factors that were going on. But I want us to talk about a few that have helped change the attitude. Sigmund Freud, who lived between 1856 and 1939. Sigmund Freud, for a long time, was kind of like the father of Western psychiatry and psychology. And his writings held a great influence. Only up until the last few years has this not been the case. And since its inception and acceptance, the idea that mental disorders or psychological problems could all be traced back to sexual repression of some sort and directing of anger and attention toward the repressors, most notably the church, again the Roman Catholic Church, that played a part in American psychology for many decades. Another thing that played a part in this was the free love movement, as we previously discussed. But also the post-World War II world, what's called the Jazz Age, where the attitudes towards certain sexual behavior were loosened somewhat, and which were restrained by previous generations who had held tightly to old values. Let's not forget or overlook or deny that the widespread use of television greatly contributed to changes in attitudes towards sexual behavior and modesty, with the ability to immediately, or at least quickly, broadcast a picture across the country and into homes where such was previously unknown. Television and movie stars became idols, and their once whispered but now public behavior was on display for everybody to see and made acceptable little by little. And for those of you who are old enough to remember, the Playboy magazine played a part in this. The first issue in December 1953 featured Marilyn Monroe on the front cover giving pornography a quote-unquote legitimate face to the public. Now this is acceptable. If she's involved, this Hollywood movie star must be okay. Before that, it was kept in the dark and in back alleys and was seen by most of society as a secret evil that was best kept secret. It's not that it didn't exist, but it was not acceptable. This made it acceptable. It's with this genuine movie star as the draw, Playboy introduced pornography to a whole new generation. Let's not overlook the invention of the pill, the invention of the first oral contraceptive in 1957 and the sale in the United States in 1960, availability in all states by 1965, and I know this sounds odd today, wasn't available to unmarried women until 1972. When it first came out, it wasn't even allowed to be prescribed to unmarried women. But no doubt it played a part in changing attitudes towards sexual behaviors previously considered risky. Feminists today hail it today as even the greatest liberating factor in the history of women. It's that important to them. But again, the 1960s counterculture played a part in this. In the 1960s, where growing opposition to the Vietnam War and rising usage of illegal drugs such as marijuana and LSD, the increasing percentage of women in the workforce, easy access to the ability to publicize causes through the growing medium of television, all played a part in this. 1973, the Supreme Court defined obscenity and changed the way things were looked at in society. In the 1973 case of Miller versus California, obscenity was defined in a three-part definition that the Supreme Court after that said had to meet all three conditions before it could be considered obscene. The average person applying contemporary community standards must find the work taken as a whole appeals to prurient interest. Two, the work depicts or describes in a patently offensive way sexual conduct specifically defined by applicable state law. And number three, the work taken as a whole lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. And of course, everything after that was called artistic. That was pornography. They were artists. They were no longer people engaging in sexual acts. They were artists. And once they took the step in that direction, there was no going back. And while some may have seen this as a step backwards in the liberalization of sexual attitudes, it didn't take long for legal challenges to arise and redefinitions of certain activities and publications and movies as ones with artistic content, quote unquote. And arguments that publications and movies with minor, quote unquote, minor portions of pornographic and deviant sexual acts didn't meet the standard for obscenity and so was put out there for the public to see. Let's not forget also in 1973 Roe v. Wade, which was still seen as a monumental decision in which the U.S. Supreme Court declared a woman has a quote unquote right to obtain an abortion, citing privacy laws and privacy rights of the women. And since then, over 50 million abortions have been performed. This is how we got to where we are today. A lot of these factors played a part in the attitudes toward sexual behavior today. What is the result of this revolution? Well, I don't want to harp too much on the things that Frederick Gray talked about last week, but I want to build on what he talked about, the entertainment industry and the loosening of sexual standards. I think even a casual investigation of the history of the entertainment industry would show a sector in our society that is comprised of many who are seeking to constantly push boundaries. And by that I mean rebel against authority, limits, laws, and restrictions. And to engage in and promote immoral and even deviant sexual behavior. Some of this stuff that comes out from time to time about people who are on the inside, about the behavior of all those involved in this kind of industry. I don't think that we can necessarily conclude that there's inherently larger percentages of those involved in the entertainment industry who engage in immoral behavior, but they are pushing it on the rest of society. But in times past, businesses used their influence to keep certain entertainers' personal behavior under control, or at least private. And now these same businesses promote those behaviors as normalized. We look at the TV and the movie industry in this country and we see the changes that have taken place. The first publicly screened movie appeared in 1895. How long do you think it took before there was the first movie where there was complete nudity? 2 years, 1897. Didn't take long. And because of increasingly numerous movies with immoral themes and subject matter in the roaring 20s, an industry-wide standard was established in 1934 called the Hays Code, which remained in place until 1967 when it was abandoned and the current MPAA standards were established, which has since been revised. The X rating has been eliminated, and now it's NC-17. And since 1967, 55% of all mainstream movies have received an R rating. And testimony before Congress in 2000 by the FTC found that 80% of R-rated movies were targeting the under 17 age group. Now, this is supposed to be movies that you don't get in if you're under 17 unless you're with a parent. Those who make the movie say that's the group that we're targeting. Well, what's in those R-rated movies? Sex and violence and profanity. One who testified before Congress said, quote, our goal was to find the elusive teenage target audience and make sure everyone between the age of 12 and 18 was exposed to the film, unquote. That's what they're aiming at. They're aiming at your kids, parents. Studies have shown that teens, on average, see 14,000 sexual references each year on TV. The RAND Corporation released a study in 2008 that found that adolescents with high exposure to TV shows with sexual content are twice as likely to engage in risky sexual behavior than those who do not watch such shows. Parents, are you watching what your kids watch? It's these TV shows, and don't think that the kids shows and Disney Channel are immune to this. They're the ones that's pushing it on your kids. It's hard to find a live-action kids show on Disney Channel nowadays that doesn't have a homosexual main character in it. We'll talk about more homosexuality in less than 2 weeks from today. But then there's pornography. There's what's called the adult entertainment industry. That's a nice way of saying pornography. When the Hays Code was established in 1934, pornography went underground for the next 30 or so years until the 1960s when the attitudes toward sexual behavior began changing. And according to the Meese Report, in 2000, listen to this, this was 19 years ago, I'm sure the number's higher now, there were 11,000 new pornographic movies produced that year. You can say, well, that's a lot, but surely that's not anywhere close to what Hollywood puts out. Hollywood puts out 300 to 400 movies per year. Pornography puts out 11,000 movies per year. That was 19 years ago. And let's understand that the internet and pornography, they have a huge tie to one another. This is a business that is $97 billion worth per year. This is not small change we're talking about here. 12% of all websites are pornography. 74% of those offer free teasers where your kids can get to it and see pornography without paying anything. Parents, you need to know this. Other studies have shown that 90% of children between 8 and 16 have been exposed to pornography. And here's parents, here's where you need to pay attention. 79% of that happened at home. 8 out of 10 happened at home. They're exposed to pornography at home. 25% of all searches done today are for pornographic content. One porn website that I'm not going to name in 2017 had 28.5 billion visits just in 2017. Do you understand this is not a small problem? And we need to be aware of it. Parents, we need to be very aware of this. I fear for my children, to be honest with you about this, because of statistics like this. They're going to run across. I've run across it accidentally. And I'm sure most of you have too, where you're doing a search for something and something you don't want to see pops up. That's how your kids will see it, and that's exactly what they want. They want that just little bit out there to get the attention of somebody, so then they start looking for it. But that's not the only industry we need to be concerned about. The music industry is just as guilty of contributing to changed attitudes toward sexual behavior. Study was shown in American Psychiatric Association said that teens who listen to sexually suggestive lyrics are almost twice as likely to engage in sexual behavior. In other words, if you talk about it enough, you sing about it enough, they're going to want to participate in it. Parents, are you listening to what your kids are listening to? And please, some of you old fogies like me, don't think that it's particular to any one genre of music either. It's there in all types of music, whether it's rap or rock and roll or pop music or country music. It's all out there, and you need to be aware of what your kids are listening to. No genre is safe from this. We can't assume that if I just listen to this one particular type of music that I'm going to be free from that. And I'm talking about the mainstream music that's out there. But our society, because of all these factors, have had changes in attitudes and changes in sex laws. The changing attitudes towards certain sexual behavior have changed dramatically within the last generation. Since the 1950s and 60s, drastic changes. Changes in laws related to sexual behavior, such as the elimination of adultery as a prosecutable crime. And I can tell you just from my own personal investigation, about 13 years ago, someone questioned me about a certain hypothetical situation, and if a man could put away his wife just for any reason. And so I literally looked up the marriage divorce laws in every state in this country. Less than half of them today, you can even divorce for adultery anymore. You can't even put it on the paperwork. So that's not even seen as a thing nowadays, as a reason for divorce. But there have been changes such as the elimination of this as a reason for divorce. Sodomy laws have been repealed or deemed unconstitutional for every state since 1970. And we've seen just the last few years, challenges to the prohibition of same-sex marriages has resulted in now the U.S. Supreme Court declaring in 2015 that it is legal in all states. The so-called sex education in this country, you know, the proponents of free love have subtly, and I believe covertly, aimed their doctrine at our children. And for the last 40 years, we've had their agenda pushed on our children in the public schools to the point that it is now a national agenda. A group called the Sexuality Information and Education Council of the United States has prominent influence on the material and curricula that is propagated in the public schools. And they've got a clear outline of what they want taught, including teaching five-year-olds about the pleasures of certain sexual activity, teaching nine-year-olds, teaching nine-year-olds about certain sexual behavior. And as we've seen just in the last few months, I've seen two articles and a video about pushing certain sexual agendas on preschoolers. Why are they doing that? Because they know that if they can get to the kids early on, they can change their attitudes and they will be thinking differently by the time they are involved in sexual activity. And so what's resulted is this sex education, as it's called, has been pushed on our children. And since 1960, the teen pregnancy rate has increased from an estimated 30 in 1,000 to now 100 in 1,000. Not really improved there. That's now one out of every 10 teenage girls. In fact, the rate has tripled. As much as sex education is trumpeted as the solution, it has not decreased the rate. And during that time when sex education was first introduced in the public schools system, it was an optional thing and eventually became mandatory. And it's been a monumental failure in preventing, but has apparently gone a long way in a means of learning how to engage in it. And what the proponents and promoters of sexual activity among teens do not like to hear is the results of their efforts. 2007, University of Minnesota study, Ann Meyer, professor of sociology. She admitted that for teen girls, depression was often a result of sexual activity when there was, quote, a lack of commitment or intimacy within the relationship, which would describe the vast majority of teenage sexual encounters. Heritage Foundation, March 2007 2007 study found 25% of teenage girls who admitted they were sexually active also admitting feelings of depression, compared with only 8% among those who are not sexually active. Found that 14% of sexually active girls had attempted suicide versus 5% of girls who were not sexually active. That's the result of the changing attitudes in this country. You may remember AIDS back in the early 80s. And since the beginning of the push for homosexual rights, its decriminalization and the push for its treatment as normal and morally equivalent to those who were heterosexual, we have seen the introduction of the AIDS virus amongst our society with over 500,000 deaths and about 50,000 new cases each year. That hasn't changed in the last 35 years. It was discovered that the virus was spread in the early 80s by risky homosexual behavior and the sharing of needles among heroin addicts. The push was made not to stereotype homosexuality as the main cause, even though it was. And attempts were made to equate heterosexual behavior as just as risky when it wasn't. And when AIDS began spreading, the media was reluctant or simply too cowardly to admit that as one of the factors. It was the government's fault because it was not enough funding to treat it. The fact is today, even 2/3 of new adult AIDS cases are due to adult homosexual behavior. In sub-Saharan Africa, where AIDS is the greatest problem in the world and is the most devastating, 22 million people have been infected, with 1.9 new cases just in 2007. 1.5 million deaths. Why? Because of risky sexual behavior. And let us not forget another result of these loosened roles, where in an attempt to eliminate all negative views of sexual behavior, children are obviously going to be produced, and so we had to have abortion to get rid of those children. If you don't think it was about getting rid of children, listen to some of the debates that are going on today. There was a video I saw just in the last 2 days of a college student talking to an answering response to a speaker who was at the campus who said a baby born and a failed abortion attempt needed to be given medical care. This 20-something college-age student said, that's not a baby. How do we get to the point where we're looking at a baby laying on a table and saying it's not a baby? Because we didn't want it. That's the only thing. And we get to the point where we can look at a human being just born, laying on a table, and declare it unhuman. We're getting close to the point of no return, people. It is disgusting beyond belief that someone would even look at another human being that way and say they're not fit to live. But that's because of all this that we're talking about today. In the drive for selfish pleasure without any repercussions, this is where we've gotten to. So what do we learn from all this, and what must we teach as the people of God? Well, the first thing that we need to learn from all this is that that's not our standard. We live by a different standard than the world. And the reason that we need to hear these things is because it touches all of us. I believe I would not be wrong in saying every family here has been touched by some sort of sexual sin. If not, count yourself blessed. But the reality is the influence on society in which we live is strong and is such that it draws many believers into its web of deceit, convincing many that it's the ultimate. They are the ultimate decider of what is right and wrong, especially on this matter. But we as God's people must remember that we live by a different and higher standard. That is, we're not here to seek to please men or even self. The Apostle Paul would note in Galatians, the first chapter, in verse 10, that if he sought to please men, he could not be a servant of God. He said, rather, in 2 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, in verse 9, that he lived, his aim was to be well-pleasing to God. That's our standard. We live on this earth not to please self, not to please society, not to get a pat on the back and someone said we're so tolerant and open. We're not here for that. We're here to please God, and that's who we should be concerned about. Society wants the people of God to conform to them rather than to conform to God's teachings. We cannot do that. We're not to be conformed to this world, Romans 12 and verse 2. We're to be transformed because we seek not to please men but to please God. If we sought to please men, again, Paul said, we cannot be servants of God. The truth is we need to come out from that world. We need to be separate from them in every way. That doesn't mean we need to move to a remote island somewhere to get away from the world, but it means we need to be different. We need to not make that our associations and our best influences. Paul asked in 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 14 several questions along the lines there. What part has this with this? He shows opposites. Believers with unbelievers. Light with darkness. The point is we have to be that different. We have to be so different that we stand out for good. Our standards have to be higher than the world's. And that means we cannot walk hand in hand with those who oppose the ways of God. And it means we have to leave behind those who refuse to walk with us as we follow that narrow path that leads to eternal life. The fact is, the great majority of mankind are going to follow the wide and easy path. They're going to indulge in whatever sexual behavior they deem fulfilling or exciting or will make them happy. People of God have to separate themselves from such behavior. It's part of the very basic core message of the gospel, teaching us the denying ungodliness and worldly lusts. We must live righteously, soberly, and godly in the present age. Well, what must we teach on this? We need to teach our kids what God's Word says about it. And the only acceptable, divinely approved sexual behavior in the passage was read earlier. The marriage bed is undefiled. Fornicators and adulterers God would judge. The only place for acceptable sexual activity is in the marriage between a husband and his own wife. That's what God said. God has one truth on this matter, while the world espouses many errors and many deviations. So when the world comments about how, quote unquote, narrow-minded it is to think that there's only one way, simply say, yes, it is. We don't need to deny that. We don't need to be ashamed of that. On this matter, God says there is only one approved sexual relationship, the union of a man with a woman as husband and wife. Sexual relationship within the marriage union is pure, undefiled, as a contrast to fornication and adultery, which will be condemned by Him. What we need to teach is man and woman are for each other. In the beginning, in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 18, God saw that it is not good that a man should be alone and decided, I will make him a helper fit for him. And we read in verses 21 through 24 that He created the woman for him to be a companion. There's some necessary conclusions we need to draw from that, that even some religious leaders in this country don't seem to see. They'll read that same passage and say, God didn't say anything that's wrong with same-sex marriage. Yes, He did. Read with me. A man shall leave his father and mother and cling to his wife. Who is his wife? That woman. Man, woman. That excludes any other pairing. Woman to woman, man to man. God created the woman for the man. God intended this union, and of necessity, the only approved sexual relationship to be between a man and a woman. Second, this union was intended by God to be a means of fulfilling his or her need for sexual fulfillment. That's what we can conclude from that. Which means the desire for the opposite sex is natural. Man for a woman and a woman for man. How do I know that? When Paul wrote in Romans the first chapter about those who did that which was not natural, women with women and men with men, that tells me that the desire for a woman to a man and a man to a woman is natural. That's what God intended. While the world is trying to convince us it's just natural for same-sex relationship is, the fact is it's not. It is against nature. We're going to talk more about that in a couple of weeks. What we must teach is we have to exercise self-control in body and mind. We've already seen that the only divinely approved sexual relationship is to be fulfilled in marriage union. So that means those of you who are not married have to exercise some self-control of the body in order to remain pure before God. But to act with purity demands one have a pure mind. Because what we think is what we do. And if we seek to be pure and maintain that purity, then we have to set our minds on the things above, not on the things that are on the earth. Colossians 3, verse 2. Even religious men can get caught up in trying to justify ungodly, lustful behavior. In the first century, Jesus condemned the common teaching of the day regarding adultery, saying to the common people, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery,' but I say to you that everyone who looks on a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Apparently there were some saying, well, as long as you don't actually do it, you can think about it. Jesus said, not so. We cannot claim sexual purity while harboring lustful thoughts. Before marriage and even in marriage, we have to exercise self-control in the mind so that we don't lust for that which is not ours. To the married man, the wise writer gave some important instructions in Proverbs 5, 15 through 23 about how to fulfill those desires rightfully so. And for all of us, we must not fool ourselves into thinking that we can seek out pornography and not face condemnation. When you type those words into Google, seeking for those things, that means you're lusting after it. You're desiring it and sinning. Don't fool yourself either by thinking that lusting after the opposite sex and sources man does not deem pornography. For example, SI, Sports Illustrated, Swimsuit Edition. Don't think that that's any better. Well, what are the consequences of these sexual sins? The plain fact is, any and all sexual relationships that are not approved by God are sinful. From just the statistics that we've looked at this morning, the history of this country's sexual path, we have seen the immediate and long-term consequences of improper and immoral sexual relationships. But we have to also consider the eternal consequences. Remember that God said that He will judge fornicators and adulterers, Hebrews 13, verse 4? Paul specifically names those several sexual sins in 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 9. Fornication, adultery, homosexuality, prostitution. As that which will forbid entry into the kingdom of God. The works of the flesh He named, Galatians 5 verse 19. Let's not fool ourselves. If we're not in the kingdom, if we're outside the kingdom, Paul describes us as without God and without hope, Ephesians 2 and verse 12. That's not a good position to be in. I realize that this subject is one that is delicate, it's sensitive, controversial. But if we ignore it, it's not going to go away. And unfortunately, far too many parents have failed and continue to fail to instruct their children in God's ways on this subject matter because they were uncomfortable or they were unsure of themselves. Parents, get comfortable. Be sure. Look into God's Word. Know what His teaching is and don't be afraid to teach it. Are you going to sound a little old-fashioned and backwards? Probably. But your kids need to hear it. And they need to understand that they're going to look backwards and old-fashioned by believing it and by living it. But their goal is not to please their friends. Their goal is not to fit in with every crowd. Their goal should be pleasing God so that they can see Him after this life is over. I've tried to be sensitive today in talking about some of these things. Some of the things I couldn't even mention. So we talked about these things as we looked up information to give to you that would be helpful in your instruction to you as a teenager, you as a young individual, to you as a parent. or to everybody else for that matter. And I understand it's sensitive, but we also need to be aware of the many problems and errors associated with this subject and to not think this will never happen here. The day we start thinking that is the day that the devil comes knocking and bringing it. Let's be prepared. Let's learn God's way on this and everything. Let's instruct one another, instruct our children, so that they are not deceived by the smooth words of society and of our spiritual enemy, who's going to try to make it look as good as possible, harmless as possible, as fun and pleasurable as possible, without considering the consequences. Let's teach the truth on this matter. Let's practice it in our own lives. Let's show that the world that we live by a higher standard on this and other matters. We live by God's ways. I know this lesson is not one that would teach someone what to do to become a child of God, but if you've heard the gospel and you've come to believe the truth that it does teach, that Jesus is the Christ and Son of God, the next question is, have you acted on that belief? Do you believe that Jesus is the Christ and Son of God? If so, the next thing you need to do is be willing to turn away from the sins that you've committed before. We call that repentance. You have a genuine sorrow for having transgressed the will of God. You desire to be right in His sight. If you're willing to confess that belief from this day forward, we'll do the next thing that God demands, and that is that you be baptized into Christ. Jesus Himself said, "He that believes and is baptized shall be saved." If you believe the gospel, you believe that. You believe that you need to do that. If you haven't done it, we plead with you to do so today. Maybe there's somebody here today that's already done that, but you've not been living faithfully before God and man, or you have sin in your life that needs forgiveness. Let's take care of that while we have this moment. Maybe you're here today and you just need the prayers of this congregation for help in some way. But whatever your need, will you come as we stand and sing?